Stocks dump as fears of a U.S. debt default loom. Evergrande's back in the news again as it defaults on yet another loan. And an OPEC output boost means inflation may be here to stay. All that and more on today's show. I'm your host, Steve Van Meter, and thanks for joining me today. As we don't just talk about the news, we talk about how the news impacts you. And with that, we've got the story of the U.S. debt de-ceiling, which is looking potentially like a default if the debt ceiling isn't raised, despite the government now getting funded till December 3rd, we still have a problem of debt coming due. And I want to explain to you why this matters. I wrote about it on Friday, but I want to share with you again before we go and hit the news why this matters to you. Is because the issue right now is there are people that have treasury bills. These are very short-term U.S. debt that matures in 12 months or less, depending on what you've bought. And if you are putting money as a corporation or a municipality in T-bills with the expectation that you're just trying to earn a little tiny bit of interest to get your cash back to fund operating expenses, and the government is not raising the debt ceiling, means your new fear is they're not going to pay the redemption of your T-bill. This is part of the reason why we've seen an uptick in the overnight reverse repo, and yet we haven't seen a big sell-off in the long bond. We've seen some of it, which we'll talk more about in a moment, but let's first hit the headlines here and talk about what's going on, because Biden is now warning, President Biden warns, that the U.S. may breach its debt limit, and he blames McConnell. Well, of course, we're always going to blame other people, and that is just the nature of how politics works, my friends. President Joe Biden warned the U.S. government is at risk of breaching the legal limit on its debt in 2 weeks, blaming Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell for what he described as a meteor headed to the U.S. economy. And sure enough, that is pretty much true. Asked after a White House speech on the debt limit dispute whether he could guarantee the U.S. wouldn't exceed the debt ceiling on his debt, Biden said, no, I can't. And he's right. That is up to Mitch McConnell, he added. I can't believe that it will be the end result because the consequence is so dire. I don't believe that, but can I guarantee it? If I could, I would. And he can't. So we go on to the next piece where Biden warning ratchets up jitters, debt ceiling anxiety tracker. Okay, now we are seeing the market finally start to price in what's going on here. President said he couldn't guarantee the U.S. won't breach its limit. We now know that. And the yield on October 21 securities, Treasury securities, surges 5 basis points to 0.12%, which is pretty high considering, well, at one point, these things were teetering on the edge of going negative. So we see dislocations in the U.S. Treasury bill curve extended as investors become more concerned about the government potentially exhausting its borrowing authority, especially after President Joe Biden warned that the government is at risk of breaching the legal limit. So maybe this is kind of like a Fed thing where there's an illegal limit, who knows, on his debt in 2 weeks. Asked after a White House speech on the debt limit, we already talked about that, the yield on October 21 maturity climbed as much as 5 basis points, with most bills maturing earlier and latter yielding 0.5%. 0.05% or less. Investors have been shying away from bills. That's why interest rates are going up, prices go down, due in late October and early November. Why? Because they're afraid they're not going to get their money back yet. Now, let's just be clear. They're not afraid they're never going to get their money back. They're afraid they're not going to get it right now when they need it. That is the issue here, is getting your money back. And that's what I want you to understand, is when people are afraid of not getting their money back, they try to unload the stuff. Price goes down, yield in turn goes up. That's exactly what we're seeing. And we're seeing people shy away. Like I said, hey, I don't want to touch that stuff because, hey, I need money now. And I'm going to explain to you why in a moment. I don't think this is having a huge effect on the long end of the curve because of what the Fed has done. So let's go on here to see that viewed as, here you go, as most a risk of delayed payment if a legislative agreement to raise or suspend the debt limit isn't reached. So all it means is, look, you're not going to get your money now, but you might get it later. So there you go. So what is the issue? Then you see this overnight reverse repo go up, and it's not exactly lockstep with what's going on with yields, but it's, you're seeing a greater demand, a continuing increase in demand in overnight reverse repo. And this is where if you need collateral, if you need treasury bills, but you don't want to go buy them, and you'd rather get them from the Fed. So I want you to be thinking the Fed is money good. Treasury bill market now pricing in uncertainty. What do you do? Rather than take your cash and buy T-bills, you go to the Fed, the overnight reverse repo, you get 0.05% from them, and you're good. And you just leave the T-bill market alone. Now, there are people, as yields go up, that says, hey, I'll take the risk on this. I may not need my money right now, and I can afford to let, if this thing goes, I can wait to get my money back. And they're going to get a higher yield for it. And that's really key, because if we go and take a look now at what's going on in the long bond, what have we seen in interest rates there? They shot up, and of course, this was being billed as, this is more of an inflation move. It's more of a different issue. But why is it stopping around 2.5%? Why can't the long bond yield, the 30-year-old, get over, say, 2.5% sustainably? Well, think about it this way. What did the Fed do back in late July? They came out with what's called two standing repo facilities. Primarily, let's focus on the one for U.S., which is accessible by securities dealers only at this time. So let's just say that you're a securities dealer and there's a selling in treasury securities going on and you're not sure, but you might need cash. You just don't know. What would you want? Would you want a T-bill at, say, 0.12%? Or anything, where the cost to go to the Fed to take that T-bill, go to the Fed to get cash, cost you 0.25%. The math doesn't make sense. But let's say you have a long bond, because everyone's selling. The dealer says, I'll take these long bonds. I'll take all of them you want to sell me, because if I need cash, I can go to the Fed at 0.05 or 0.25%. Meanwhile, what's the yield? 2.5%. So even if they miss a payment on the interest and it comes back, say, a month later or as soon as the debt ceiling limit is lifted, the securities dealers are made whole, then what's going to happen immediately after that? Bond prices are going to go up, interest rates are going to go back down, and what are the dealers going to do? They're going to sell it back to the people who sold it, because now they know it's money good. And so it seems to me that why the dealers are taking on this inventory is because they have access to standing repo facility, and they're not worried if the government doesn't raise it right away, that they will eventually raise it, they will get their money back, and if they need cash, they're one of the few that can get it. All right, now let's continue on. So I want you to understand that this is why yields have been rising a bit. It's due to uncertainty, but the odds are as soon as this debt ceiling issue is done, yields are coming back down. Now let's move on to what's going on with Evergrande, because things, well, just when you think they might get better, they get a lot worse. And there's again, we talk about the risk of where this can go in the broad economy. Is Evergrande a one-off situation, or are there more? And due to the fact that real estate's about 30% of China's GDP, this is a serious issue for the global economy. So when they missed another bond payment on Sunday, this wasn't actually a shock. It was largely expected, although people that own that debt are hoping otherwise. And the company says work on 20 suspended development projects has resumed. So I want you to understand that Evergrande is saying, we're not going to pay back the people we owe money to. We're going to prioritize the people that have built or have contracts to have us build these apartments or homes or whatever they're building and get those completed. Then I want you to think, how does the Chinese government approach this? If you're Beijing, what do you want? You want upset debt holders? Nah. Or do you want upset people that didn't get their property? You want people in their property. Worry about your debt holders later. And so here we see that Evergrande missed a second bond coupon payment in as many weeks, renewing concerns over its ability to repay over $300 billion in liabilities. They're the world's most indebted developer, according to Nikkei Asia, and has little cash left in his missed payments to suppliers, banks, and retail debt holders, too. It was due to pay $46 million in interest to bondholders on an offshore bond, so it would be a dollar-denominated bond. By midnight Wednesday, New York time, but two investors said on Thursday they had neither received payment nor notice from the company, and all they have indeed is silence. So, of course, now both investors said there and other bondholders started working with advisors to form a committee. This is great, a committee that will be able to jointly press their claims with the company. How bad is it when normally if you have debt against a company, you have a senior position to be told, you actually, you don't. We're going to prioritize getting buildings built. Forget you if you owe us money. Now, what do you think that's going to cause investors to want to do? Unload Evergrande stock, which will make it harder for them, and not lend them any more new money, particularly if you're a bank. So let's continue on. Now, they do have 30-day grace period, but at this point, it does not appear likely that they are going to make good on that. Anything could happen, but who actually knows what is coming? So shares are traded on Evergrande, but not due to missing the payment. Well, because a major announcement came that they were actually going to unload part of its property development management unit, and that got sold, let's see, 51% of it to Hobson Development Holdings, whose shares were also suspended. So what I kind of thought at first when you see the suspension of stock that maybe this company's going under, nope, they're just trying to raise cash. But China now is stepping up efforts to ring fence it, not bail it out. Remember, we heard rumors, we talked about this over a week ago, that perhaps that we're going to get a bailout. Nope, they're trying to contain it. And Beijing nudges banks to ease credit and support real estate firms. Now, I want you to think about this. If you're a bank and you're seeing what's going on here, are you going to want to lend to them knowing that they're not going to pay you? Probably not. That would be my guess. But you never know. And Move is now showing that China will put home buyers ahead of bond creditors. So as China Evergrande moves closer to a massive restructuring, Beijing has stepped up efforts to limit the fallout, signaling it's willing to prop up healthy developers, homeowners, and the real estate market at the expense of global bondholders. And this is important because when you lose confidence, what do people want to do? The value of those bonds goes down. That means banks have to hold more collateral. Investment funds have to, you know, insure them against loss. And things go wrong, and it just means the appetite to buy more of this type of debt goes down. You get a financial tightening, and all of a sudden, you look at a potential global crisis brewing. And of course, you're seeing this in real time. And last week alone, China. The authorities dispatched top financial regulators to nudge the country's massive banks to ease credit for home buyers and support the property sector. They also bought out part of the Evergrande struggling bank unit. And look, this is the bottom line. The moves underscore that China will do everything it can to ring fence Evergrande while showing little interest in a direct bailout of the developer that has roiled global markets for weeks. Doesn't bode well for bondholders both onshore and abroad looking for some kind of rescue for the Chinese government. And so now we move on to OPEC. What is the issue here is high crude oil prices. You know, normally people look at this and say, well, that's a sign of inflation. Actually, high crude oil prices cause inflation because crude is used in so many goods that are produced that when crude prices go up, it leads to higher prices. And there is a point where higher prices are not good. So if you're in a recovery phase, whether it's an economic recovery, could be a physical recovery, but could be emotional, could be an employment recovery, what is it you want? Starting out, baby steps, that first step of, hey, I've got to make get to work today. That's my goal, is just to get to work. It's a recovery. And think of it from the economy and these baby steps. And what does the economy not need right now? Higher prices in energy, because when you have all these people who are on unemployment that are now not, that are presumably going to go look for work, what are they going to be immediately faced with? Higher energy prices. What don't they have to pay that, afford that? Incomes. Their incomes are going down because of lack of government support. And how does that translate into the broad economy? Well, if more money has to go to energy costs, then less money goes into discretionary and other spending, and that causes the economy to shrink. So what an emerging economy out of, say, a recession or a pandemic in this case, you could obviously say it's one and the same given the relapse in the economy that would have happened had it not been for the fiscal stimulus that we're seeing potentially happen now, is we need lower crude oil prices. We need significantly lower energy prices so businesses and households can recover. And so OPEC comes out today with an announcement. And what do they say? They opt against a big output boost, pushing oil prices to 7-year high. And that is not necessarily a good thing. As previously said, they would add about 400,000 barrels a day each month through next year. And well, that's what they decided to do. They decided to keep their taps pretty closed, and this decision sent oil prices higher. And again, this is not what the economy, the global economy needs. You're hearing everywhere around the world that there's energy shortages, and the energy producers saying, hey, this is great, this will drive up prices. And what they don't realize is those higher prices will ultimately be rejected because consumers will not be able to afford them and will not be able to afford the other goods and services that come with it. And that's why we look at the consumer price index year over year against crude oil year over year. And what does this suggest to us? That, well, we do know that at some point the year over year rate of change of consumer price index will come down, but now the risk is if crude oil prices stay higher, that it will become sticky at a level still too high for consumers to cause them to get the recovery we need. And that now may be why, when we head over to this piece out of China, the cost of shipping between China and the U.S. plunges, and this is kind of surprising people, that the cost of shipping plunged this week after hitting record highs in early September. Now, why would that be? Because you see this chart, and you from Zero Hedge looking at container rates that are just off the chart. Why would it be important for shippers to contain and try to lower cost of shipping? Think of it from the global manufacturing thought, right? I've got a factory in China because they're a low-cost producer and shipping wasn't that expensive. Now shipping prices are getting ridiculous. The supply chains are a big problem in general, and prices are not that much better. So what might I do? Shift my production to the U.S. And what does China not want is production shifting out of its country. It does not want that. And so one thing that they're going to look to do is try to get shipping prices back down to make sure they stay competitive. And so this might be just the first step in that, because crude oil is going to be a problem, but perhaps there will be some offset due to lower shipping prices. Now let's take a look at what's driving the part of the stock market is massive junk bond issuance. Now I hear all the time people say, well, the market is pricing in growth. The market is right. The market knows it's not a Ponzi scheme in itself. It's actually being funded by people investing in what we find as issuance of speculative grade loans to finance dividends. And it's a record $72 billion in 2021. And U.S. companies have sold a record amount of junk debt to fund dividends. Now, why are they able to do this? Because U.S. investors are dying to buy U.S. junk-rated debt. They think it's a great buy. They don't realize what you are about to understand right now is that non-financial companies, including insurance provider Asurion LLC and a fast food chain Whataburger, have issued more than $72 billion worth of speculative-grade loans to pay dividends in 2021, according to S&P Global Market Intelligence. That's already a full-year record in data going back to 2000, topping 2013's previous high of $54.4 billion. This record marked one sign companies are becoming more comfortable with their cash-stuffed balance sheets and the economy's trajectory. Keep in mind, what if the economy rolls over? Leveraged loans are typically issued by companies with significant debt relative to their earnings, making them more sensitive to the economy's trajectory. So if the economy rolls over, these companies are going to have a massive problem with all this debt. And now economists are raising growth forecasts as a bunch of, what do we have, 8 million people come off of some form of government unemployment benefit just over the last couple of weeks, suggesting a rebound in spending, which we still have not figured out where this money is going to come from, and production slowed by supply chain disruptions and COVID-19 variant. This helps offset consequences of issuing debt to fund dividends, which can weigh on companies' credit ratings and borrowing capacity since the money isn't used for operations. They've also issued a record amount of junk bonds this year, while leveraged loan sales are on pace to surpass 2017's record of $503 billion. And so what you see is leverage in the corporate sector. And they're betting on the economy continuing to boom. They're betting on consumers willing to spend. But are consumers going to keep spending? That should be the question you're asking. And for that, we need to talk about the University of Michigan surveys that came out on Friday. And here we see the final results for September 2021. Consumer sentiment up slightly from 70.3 to 72.8. Says overall, consumers were a little bit more confident in September than they were in August. Economic current conditions improved from 78.5 to 80.1. And expectations, this is future, went from 65.1 to 68.1. Now you might say, wow, that's great news. Consumers are more optimistic. They'll spend more. Well, let's look at the notes here. Consumer sentiment edged upward in late September, although the overall gain still meant the continuation of depressed optimism. Depressed optimism, that's interesting. Initially sparked by the Delta variant, supported by persistent inflation and unfavorable long-term prospects for the national economy. So when consumers are saying, look, the situation is not good. Consumers do not view economic conditions as conducive to establishing inflationary psychology as self-fulfilling prophecy. So there you see it, that consumers don't buy into the inflation narrative. And so what does that tell you? You know, I want you to think about that. What does that mean? If consumers don't believe that inflation will persist, how are they going to handle spending money? It's really simple. If you think prices are going to continue to rise on something you want to buy, what do? You buy it now. And how do you buy it now if you can't afford it? You borrow the money. If you think prices are going to fall, what do? You don't borrow money. You don't spend money. You pay off debt in a debt-based economy, or you save money. That's not what you want to see at all. Instead, consumers have favored, here we go, postponement due to what they still consider transient spike in prices. Okay, let's look at the data. These charts provided by Zero Hedge. Here you see in blue the consumer sentiment overall survey, current conditions in green, and expectations in red. Expectations and overall sentiment are back at their pandemic lows. Only thing that is better, slightly better, is current conditions. So it's not that consumers are a lot more optimistic. They're just slightly more optimistic, again, from a depressed level. And why shouldn't they be very depressed? Because inflation expectations are high. If you want to look at something that will tell you that interest rates are likely to head lower, well, look here at 2008. Remember, interest rates went up and they came crashing down. Well, there you can see inflation expectation happened again in 2010, and it's looking to set that up again. Moving on to buying conditions, phenomenal chart. I love these charts. It shows buying condition for homes, a terrible. I mean, you're going back to 1980 to find a time, and 2005 to 2000, or probably around 2008, when it was the worst time in the mind of consumers to buy a home, yet they're still buying them. Oh, wait, that's large durables in orange. I was looking at large durables. Houses, well, we don't have as low as 1980, but we're down there. We're worse than it was during the financial crisis. And how about vehicles? Well, that's as low as it's ever been. And again, you start to look at what companies are doing. They're leveraging up, thinking there's going to be a boom, and consumers are saying, I'm not going to buy. In fact, it gets even worse as we look over here and see buying conditions for homes, buying conditions for durables. Here's the other bad. These are bad buying conditions, just off the charts. And what does that tell you, my friends? That the show for today is over, and I appreciate all of you for being fans. I appreciate supporting the show, because what you're seeing is leverage in a bubble that's going to pop when the consumers don't have the money to spend. And with that, we'll see you back on Wednesday. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being with me. And until then, yes, I know I got to click something. Got to have the screen ready. I'll see you back then. Thanks for watching. Bye now. Content of this video is provided as educational information only. It's not intended by investor or other advice. Shows not to be construed as recognition or solicitation by selling a security financial instrument or participating in particular trading strategies. This video was prepared by Steve Van Meter in personal capacity. Business expresses video that do not reflect the view of Atlas Financial Advisors, Inc. or Steve Van Meter Financial.